One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
A Ukrainian couple who grew tired of arguing are trying to repair their relationship by tying their hands together for 3 months. The two plan to document their experiences on social media. 33-year-old Alexander Kudlay and 28-year-old Victoria Pustovitova began what they call their experiment on Valentine's Day in February. Since that time, they have gained thousands of followers on Instagram. They tied themselves together with handcuffs, a set of two metal rings that are joined together and locked around their wrists. Kudlay recently told Reuters reporters, "In terms of physical comfort, with every day passing, we are getting used to it more and more. It gets easier." He came up with the idea after Pustovitova said she wanted to break up with him. "We used to break up once or twice a week. When during another fight, Vika once again said that we had to break up, I replied, 'Then I will attach you to myself.'" Pustovitova refused his idea at first. She hung up the telephone on him the first time he suggested it. But after a while, she changed her mind. For nearly a month, neither of them has had any personal space. They do everything together, from food shopping to taking a break to smoke. Pustovitova said, "I decided it will be an interesting experience for me, that it will bring into my life new bright emotions which I had not experienced before. I love him, so I came to a decision to do it." Now they put pictures of themselves on Instagram showing a happy existence. They have also appeared on talk shows on Ukrainian television. As for their relationship, some tension has come up, but the couple say they have found new ways of dealing with disagreements. "Fights between us did not disappear. We still fight," Kudlay said. "But when we approach a dead end and there is no understanding between us, we simply stop talking instead of packing up our things and walking away. Pack up means to gather things together so that you can take them with you." Public opinion about their decision has been a mix of praise, doubt, and curiosity. Among the most important questions is how the couple goes to the toilet. The answer? The other has to wait outside with a hand remaining inside the bathroom. They take turns showering. I'm John Russell.
Scientists have discovered an extreme case of regeneration. Some sea slugs can regrow hearts and whole new bodies after having their heads cut off. It is being called a wonder of nature and was recently reported in Current Biology. This discovery could help scientists better understand how to regenerate or regrow human tissue in the future. Biology researcher Sayaka Mito said she loves studying Japanese sea slugs because they are small, cute, and strange. They can even briefly photosynthesize like a plant, drawing food from the sun. Her research at Nara Women's University sounds like something from out of a scary movie. While studying these small cute creatures in the lab one day, she saw something strange. A sea slug had cut off its own head, but kept on living and moving. Then a couple more sea slugs did the same. So Mito and another researcher, Yoichi Yusa, tried it themselves. They cut off the heads of 16 sea slugs. Six of the creatures started regeneration. Three of them survived. One of the three even lost and regrew its body twice. And two different kinds of Japanese sea slugs went through the regeneration process. Other creatures can lose body parts when needed. For example, some lizards drop their tails to get away from danger and regrow them later. This is a biological event called autotomy. We think that this is the most extreme case of autotomy, Yusa said. He added that some animals can autonomize their legs or tails, but no other can drop their whole body. One kind of sea slug can grow to 15 centimeters long. Scientists had long thought that a creature that size could not survive without a heart to pump blood and nutrients to the brain. Canadian marine biologist Susan Anthony is not part of the study, but she agreed with Yusa. The thing that makes Japanese sea slugs special is probably what helps it do this trick. When these sea slugs eat a certain type of algae, Yusa said, they can photosynthesize their food from sunlight and oxygen, just like a plant, for about 10 days. He guessed that after decapitation, the head sort of acts like a plant. It turns green and gets its energy from oxygen and sunlight. Mito and Yusa said that sea slugs probably developed this ability as a way of fighting off parasites. Humans may be able to learn something useful from the sea creatures, several scientists have said. Nicholas Curtis is a biology professor at Ave Maria University. He was also not part of the study. What is especially interesting, he said, is that these sea slugs are more complex than other creatures that are known to regenerate. In an email, Curtis wrote, "It is, of course, a wonder of nature. But understanding the underlying molecular mechanisms involved could help us to understand how our cells and tissues can be used to repair damage." I'm Anna Mateo.
In Dubai, airport passengers are now being offered the chance to use their eyes to confirm their identity without the need to show any documents. The system was launched as the United Arab Emirates continues to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. The government has pointed to the program as a tool to help control the spread of the new coronavirus because it does not require airport passengers to have contact with other people. The system uses a biometric method. Biometric systems are designed to collect biological data that is unique to each person in order to identify individuals. Facial recognition is one kind of biometric method. Such systems use similar methods to those used in fingerprinting technology. The system in Dubai uses equipment to scan a person's iris, the colored part of the eye. This requires passengers taking part in the program to look directly into a camera so biological data can be collected. The use of eye scan systems has become more widespread across the world in recent years because of concerns about the accuracy of facial recognition technology. Iris biometrics are considered more dependable than systems that scan people's faces from a distance. At Dubai's airport, the world's busiest for international travel, people could be seen stepping up to an eye scanner after checking in for their flights. After looking into the camera, they were approved to pass through passport control within seconds. The passengers did not need to carry paper tickets or use electronic documents to complete the process. Officials in Dubai say the document-free passage is possible because the scan connects a person's iris data to the state's facial recognition database. The system is a partnership between airline company Emirates and Dubai's Immigration Office. Officials say the system quickly moves travelers through an automated process from check-in to boarding the plane. Major General Obaid Mahir Bin Soror is Deputy Director of Dubai's General Directorate of Residency and Foreign Affairs. He told the Associated Press, "The future is coming." He said the system had become very smart, taking only 5 to 6 seconds to complete the scan process. But just as with Faram has added to fears of disappearing privacy for individuals. The UAE has already faced international criticism for targeting journalists and human rights activists. In a privacy statement relating to its biometric system, Emirates says the airline links passengers' faces with other personally identifying data, including passport and flight information. It adds that the information can be kept for as long as it is reasonably necessary for the purposes for which it was collected. All collected biometric data is stored within the General Directorate of Residency and Foreigner Affairs, Emirates says on its website. The airline adds that its methods are in line with the European Union's law on data protection and privacy. The data can, however, be used across the airport for identification purposes, Emirates said. Bin Soror said all personal passenger data kept by Dubai immigration officials is completely protected so that no third party can see it. Jonathan Frankel is a doctoral student in artificial intelligence at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He told the AP that any kind of surveillance technology raises red flags, regardless of what kind of country it's in. But, he added, in a democratic country, if the surveillance technology is used transparently, at least there's an opportunity to have a public debate about it. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
Three days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. The following year, the Korean War ended with an armistice, a ceasefire agreement. During his presidency, Eisenhower began a tradition of meetings between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. He met with Soviet leaders Nikolai Bulganin and Nikita Khrushchev. These meetings may have helped reduce the threat of a nuclear war between the two countries during the Cold War. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment throughout America's corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
At the end of Eisenhower's first term, he was still very popular. He had suffered a heart attack, but the Republican president felt strong enough to campaign again in 1956. His Democratic Party opponent was Adlai Stevenson. They had been the candidates in the presidential election 4 years earlier. This time, Eisenhower won almost 10 million more votes than Stevenson, an even bigger victory than in 1952. Eisenhower's second term, however, presented problems. The Soviet Union launched the space age by putting the first satellite into orbit around Earth. Fidel Castro established a communist government in Cuba. Many white Americans were fighting the Supreme Court's decision to end racial separation in schools. And the American economy suffered a recession. Eisenhower's popularity dropped during his second term. This would make it difficult for the Republican Party's next candidate for president. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate 3 times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected President of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin, but voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution. And that," he said, "includes the separation of the government from any religion or church." Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold 4 debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last 2. In the 4th debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On Election Day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.